This is the Auntie M Brain Tumors Talk Show. It's a show full of informative chat and inspirational messages. The Auntie M Brain Tumors Talk Show on podcast. Thank you that you're going to do the interview with me. So if we go back to when you were originally diagnosed with a brain tumor, which is in 2013.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was diagnosed in the gene. It took about 6 attempts to go to the GP and then being referred to ENT, because the only symptom I was aware of was that I had this sort of what they call pulsatile unilateral tinnitus in my right ear. Mm-hmm. So that's where you hit heartbeat in your ear. I had at the time balance problems. I had a very odd posture because the tumor had upset my balance and I was almost leaning over to the right, and I had a lot of back pain, a lot of abdomen pain from that. But it's only now with the hindsight that you actually realize, now I can see why I had all those symptoms. I had the scan done on a Thursday. The Friday I phoned the secretary, actually. I said, there's something on my scan. I think you need to see me. And the secretary then phoned me back that afternoon and said, we'd like to see you Monday morning at 9 o'clock. So I actually had the weekend. And then the Monday morning I went in with my husband. I'm now divorced. They showed me the scan. They told me I would then hear from Madam Brooks shortly, which took about another month to actually have the appointment to come through to go to Addenbrookes to go to the specialised neuro center. I was then off work from just the stress and anxiety of knowing that I got 2 brain tumours and just trying to cope. Psychologically, I had 2 brain tumours in my cerebellum and at the back of the brain in what's called the occipital lobe, right next to the main vein, which the one in my cerebellum was causing me the symptoms that I was having. And it was a point where it's starting to press on my brain stem. So I had that one removed. And then for the last 10 years, I've been on, I hate calling it watch and wait. I call active monitoring, which subsequently I now need the second one taken out.
Do you feel relief they will be both out?
I think so. I knew in May this needed to come out and I'm still waiting for a date. It's because I'm asymptomatic and because there are people who are more poorly than me and it's complex surgery, I can absolutely understand that. But the psychological worry of worrying about, okay, they said I might have a seizure, when actually having this out, I didn't want to face. I was actually quite poorly post my last surgery. I was in hospital nearly 2 weeks. I had to learn to walk again because my balance had been affected by the fact it was in my cerebellum. So that's your fine motor skills. And I don't know. It's just something I've accepted that might happen one day, and it's going to at some point. But I think with the fact that I've also been given the diagnosis that I have neurofibromatosis type 2, but what it does, it gives you benign tumours on your nerve roots. Quite commonly, it gives you tumours on your hearing nerves. So a lot of people go deaf with this. I think with knowing that I have this neurofibromatosis type 2 now, I know it is probably quite likely I'm going to have more tumours. I have been told I have 5 in my spine as well, which are now going to be monitored. So actually, the inevitability of I will probably need more surgery throughout the rest of my life off and on, potentially, it's something I've got to get my head around. They're being watched and they're being looked at. And in some ways, that's reassuring that somebody's going to keep an eye on me. I don't like the prospects of possibly needing spinal surgery. I'll cross that bridge when I come to it. I have to. I've got no choice in the matter.
Yeah.
It is what it is, really. It's hard, isn't it?
Yeah, no, it is. It's awful. How have you dealt with it? Have you found certain ways of coping?
I've got an amazing amount of friends who are so supportive and they've been superb looking after me. I will talk things through with them. I'm divorced, but I'm with a new partner. He's superb. I think my coping mechanism is to talk about things. I am at the moment, I'm being referred to some counselling for the NF2 side of things as well, because that has connotations for my children. I've got 2 daughters. If I'm waiting, they have said basically because I have these 2 brain tumours, I have tumours in my spine, clinically, I have this NF2, but I haven't got the genetics through yet. If I do have the gene for it, and they will also test the tumor when they take it out as well. And they've only been doing that for the last year, 18 months, from what I understand. So it's quite a new thing. My children might have that gene as well. It's a 50% chance that they will have it. So trying to cope with that, which is, as a parent, there's a certain responsibility and a fear of, if I've given it to them, how do I manage that to look after them? Mm. I think at the time of the initial diagnosis, I did fall to pieces a bit. I remember my mom saying to me when I told her I was, my diagnosis, why you? And I turned around to her and said, why not me? It's facing it and, okay, I'll have control of this. The other thing I think with the diagnosis, the absolute major thing for me, for my support, was the Meningioma UK group on Facebook. And they was talking to other people who have gone through the same thing is important. Okay. And actually for me, because I work in the NHS, I'm about looking after other people. So I could use my expertise. There's been things where people are going, what does this word mean on my scan? I can tell them.
Yeah.
So I can help others. And for me, that's how I come at. But yeah, you have to just, I think you just have to get on with it and have that positive attitude to it. Okay, what do I do? Where are my next steps? How do I go forward with this? Mm. Because it is a major life-changing diagnosis.
What were the things that you needed help with after the first surgery? What was the thing that took the longest for you to get back to some sort of normality?
It was mobility was the main thing. I remember in the village that I lived, I got a dog, an elderly dog, and I'd been home a couple of weeks after my surgery. My 19-year-old niece had come to look after me and she had then gone home. So I was on my own for the first time and I lived in a little close which got a pond onto the main road. So I thought, I'll take the dog for a walk. I just wanted to get out of the house. Mm. And I must have taken about half an hour to do this trip, which would have only taken 5 minutes at the most. Mm. I was walking the dog and one of my neighbours, one of my friends who lived down the further part of the village, who was probably in her late 60s at the time, was driving out of the village. She pulled over. She came out of her car and she was like, are you all right? Are you all right? And tried to guide me round. I was like, "What? I am having a walk. I'm doing this slowly." And I thought that was actually very sweet. But quite amusing considering she was old enough to be my mum at the time. But yeah, that confidence and that ability to do normal things again and the fatigue. Oh my God, the fatigue. That was the main thing. And I still get that now, whether that's my age, because I'm a woman of a certain age. But the fatigue, that was one of the hardest things. And the I am tired, I need to sleep. Mm. And then waking up and still feeling I am tired.
Try and explain to someone yeah, what fatigue is. What would you say for you, what is your fatigue? Like for mine, it's my speech goes and I just can't focus. And it's not even my body is tired. It's my brain switches off and then I get a bit weird.
Yeah.
And then it makes me anxious because I'm like, am I going to have a seizure? Because I'm like, I'm going into weird mode. But that for me is my fatigue. But I don't know what someone else's fatigue feels like them to them.
My fatigue would be I would get tinnitus in my ear again, which I don't get regularly. That is a warning sign you're getting tired or I'm stressed. I get that. But I think it's I'm a bit my words are there, but they're the wrong words. Mm-hmm. Recently, I went to Rome with my partner earlier in the year. And we were in every country but Rome, but Italy. We were in Germany. We were in Spain. We were in France. Not once did I say you sleep. And it's because I was tired. Yeah. And I just, it doesn't quite spark properly, does it? You don't.
You know what you're trying to say and just it's not coming out right.
I come out with the wrong words so many times. But when I'm particularly exhausted, it just goes completely to pot.
Yeah.
But for me, that's probably the major thing, actually, that does happen. It's very weird. And it's quite funny at times.
Oh, no, it is. Yeah. I used to get quite offended. Not offended, but I used to be embarrassed because my words would be jumbled up. Yeah. And then now it's like, they say, oh, it's a clarism. And we like, they're like, oh, you should make a book from all these words that I come up with. Like telling to my mum once, and I said, what was it? The song that goes Barcelona with Queen. Yeah. So it was playing and I said, oh, I love that song. And I said, Mascarpone. And I said, oh, Mascarpone. And my mum was like, what are you talking about? And I was like, the song, I love it. And she's like, you mean Barcelona? I was like, oh, yeah, that's it.
It's forever going to be Mascarpone to me now. The other thing I get is quite clumsy. I'm clumsy anyway, but recently I fell into my car. I went to sit down in the passenger seat and I just fell in. My friends are like, oh, God, what are you like? It's the kind of thing I do. A year after my surgery, I actually fell down some steps in London. We'd gone to see the poppies at the tower.
Oh, yeah.
And we were going to one of the underground stations. I think it was London Bridge. And I fell down about four steps.
Oh.
And that was because I was tired. And I ended up having to have a hip operation.
Oh, yeah, but they are solid, aren't they? They're like brick.
And I must admit, somebody can stop and say, you're okay. And you're embarrassed. And I picked myself up and I was limping back. And it turned out I'd actually torn the lining of my hip.
Oh, wow.
So the actual hip joint called the labrum. Mm. So I ended up having to have surgery on that. And I was a bit like, that's because my balance is rubbish and I was tired. So, yeah, those sort of things are a little bit dangerous.
Yeah, and then they set you back a bit for your confidence.
Oh, yeah. That was something it took quite a long time, actually, going up and down the stairs to get the balance right. I have poor 3D vision anyway. So having that plus a tumour that upsets your balance, then I'm going to fall over.
My hand is out. Whenever I'm going up or downstairs, my hand is always out to hold on to something. My balance is gone. I don't have my tumour, but my balance, because I'm partially blind, I don't know. But I'm like, I'm always holding on. to get down this and up the top of the stairs.
When I went to London last week with a partner and his children and going up and down the underground stations, I'm like, I'm holding on to the rail. I don't care if people are rushing. Yeah. I don't particularly like really noisy, claustrophobic atmospheres either, but I think that's about me being claustrophobic, to be honest. But I find too much noise. I can cope with it better now, but post-op, too much noise was just really horrendous.
What do you do?
My ex-husband.
Do you leave the room or do you just put up with it? With the noise?
Don't look away from it. At work, I have noise cancelling headphones because I sit in an open office.
Mm.
Yeah. But when I post my surgery, my ex-husband bought one of these soundbars for the TV.
Mm.
And it used to make me feel physically sick, the noise coming through it and the bass.
Yeah.
Oh, I feel really sick. What's making me feel sick? And it was the soundbar.
Mm.
It's just weird, isn't it?
Yeah, I have exactly the same. My husband had one. And when he played it once, I was like, oh, please turn it off. I'm like, my heart is going boom. And I don't feel good. Yeah. And it's really weird.
No.
And so he doesn't use that.
Yeah, it's really nice to actually hear somebody else say that because I thought I was weird.
No, I do. Anything that's a booming sound, if it's got a beat, I don't know whether that's anxiety or whether that is just something about my hearing because I've got hyperacusis from surgery and I don't know if that's what that is, but I'm like, please turn it down, which I feel so boring because I know how fun it is to watch a movie with the booming in the sound, but I'm like, I can't do it.
No, it makes it feel really unwell.
There's so many little different things and they feel like a small thing when you say it, but they all build up together and it feels like a constant battle that you're constantly dealing with every day.
You feel like you're being awkward.
Oh, yeah.
And it's, I'm really sorry, but could you do this? Could you do that? And it is,
I don't know. We have to laugh sometimes.
Yeah.
It's one of those things where you can't laugh because you've got nothing to do with the brain tumour, but we can laugh. We've had it.
Did you name your tumour? Did you give it a name?
I didn't have time. I don't know what I would if I did. I think I probably would have just swore or something like that or had some horrible, really rude word. But I didn't have the time. I didn't have time to. I had 3 days from finding out to having surgeries. Okay. But I love some of the other ones that people have. Did you name yours?
Yeah.
Oh, what is
it? Yeah, I did. The one... This is a bit of a funny story. The major one that I had, I called Sonia. Because when I was training as a radiographer, there was a group of us. I trained in Norwich. And there was a group of us. One of the girls is called Sonia, who I loved a bit. She was great fun. but she used to get a lot of headaches. And I think it was probably the stress of all the training. And she used to say, it's my tumor. It's my brain tumor causing her headaches. So it became Sonia. And then the other one I called Bean, but I still got Bean at the moment. But I found for me, by giving it a name, for me, because I had from June to September before the surgery, giving it a name gave me control.
Yes.
I was naming it. I was calling it something. And it was like, it's been served. It's eviction notice going.
That's a really good way of putting it.
Yeah. I think a lot of people do name them to actually have that control, and also that it's a thing, rather than it also stops you using the word, I've got brain tumor. You can have that in narrative in your head about this thing, but without naming it.
Yeah, there was someone that called, there's someone, she called it Baltimore. I thought that was just great.
Yeah,
it was just the evil, horrible thingy that she called Baltimore.
Yeah, I love it.
I hope that they're going to be able to do something sooner, or at least so that you can have a plan.
At the moment, I can't plan my life more than a month ahead. Mm. If I need to go somewhere or do anything, it's all, can I wait another couple of weeks before I book tickets for that or whatever? Because I know I'm going to need surgery at some point, and I'm hoping I won't be as poorly as I was last time. Yeah. But it's like Christmas, my youngest daughter doesn't live with me. She lives with her dad. And there's been you having her for Christmas. I don't know. I really don't know. I don't know, one, if I'm going to be well enough. And I don't know what my situation is. It's, oh, do you want to come to this Christmas party? Oh, I don't know. It's, I'll come for a drink, but I won't book a menu because I don't want to pay out money if I'm not going to be able to go. Yeah. But also, I don't want to let other people down. The friend contacted me the other day about something to go to a sort of a Christmas party do. There was £60 a ticket, and I'm like, I would, but I can't. I just can't say yes to anything at the moment. Yeah. Or there's plans made, and we might have to cancel that at the last minute. And friends are being very understanding. They're like, if we need to reschedule, we'll reschedule. But yeah, it is hard. It is hard not knowing. I'm a planner. I don't like living like this.
Yeah.
It doesn't work.
Yeah.
It isn't nice.
Yeah. How often do you have an MRI at the moment?
So what I was on, I had a 5-year annual follow-up, and then it was biannual. So I had my biannual one done this January, and then I was on a telephone consultation call up. So they would phone me and they would say, yep, everything's stable. I like that word, stable. And that we'll see you in 2 years' time. So this time I got a phone call saying, we'd like to put you back through the MDT meeting. So that's the multidisciplinary team meeting where they discuss your scans, they discuss your symptoms. On those MDT meetings, if they've got pathology, they will discuss that as well. So they'll make treatment plans about what needs to happen next. And they said, oh, we actually, looking at your scans, your tumour has grown quite a lot in the last 7 years. I don't know why it's 7 years. So we'd like to put you back through the MDT. But I was like, what are you thinking? Oh, we'll probably scan you another year, but we just want to put you through that belt and braces process and making sure they've got all the right minds, all the neurosurgeons, there'll be the clinical nurse specialists will be there, pathologists will be there, and they will make a collective decision with their skills and knowledge about what's the best for that individual patient. And then I got basically a letter to ask me to go to an outpatient clinic, which is when they then discuss the options about actually this needs to come out. But I don't know what my regime will be going forwards once I've had this surgery. I assume I'll be back to square one again. It'll be a 5-year follow-up and then every other year for another 2 years. But I don't know.
Did you have the scan at the place you worked?
I had the scan at the place where I worked. So I'd never had an MRI scan. I've been qualified as a radiologist for 30 odd years now. So when I trained, MRI wasn't really a thing. It was more research and it was just coming into the NHS. So I've never actually worked on MRI as a radiographer. And I went down to the MRI scanners because I'm actually very claustrophobic. And I went down and I looked at the scanner and went, I'm not getting on. So I then went to my GP and got some diazepam, which is how I managed to do the scan. Mm. But also the radiography in there were absolutely superb. They looked after me really well. I had my scan done and I was told it would only be a 10-minute scan. It turned into an hour. And halfway through, they said they want to give you contrast. Now, being a radiographer, I panic because I know you get given contrast when you know there is something they need to characterize more. So at that point, I panicked. I demanded to come out. I needed to sit up. I actually cried. And I can't fault the radiographers there. They were just amazing. They really looked after me incredibly well. And that I'll always be grateful for. They were superb.
Yeah. And they saw your scan. Did they tell you immediately or did they wait a bit?
The radiographers, they're on. What has to happen is that the scan is then read by a radiologist. And then it's that scan report that goes back to your referrer, who then is the person who gives you those results. Mm. At the time, they weren't allowed to tell me anything because they couldn't. It hadn't been read properly, but it needed to go through the right process, which is, that is the right way. There's no way they're going to give somebody bad news on the day, and they're not allowed to. It's beyond their professional remit anyway. Although there are radiographers out there who do reporting when you're scanning or you're doing whatever to a patient, you don't give them information about what you can see on the scan. It's beyond your scope of practice, basically. But yeah, so they had obviously, you do know, you do look at the scans, you think, oh, that doesn't look very good or whatever. But you can't impart that knowledge to the patient. You have to stay quite professional. I'm still registered as a radiographer, but I'm in chest management now, and I've been out of clinical work for the last 2.5 years. And that's been for various reasons, but I actually used to run a breast screening service.
Okay.
So very used to patients with life-changing diagnoses, very used to dealing with patients who are getting bad news. And it's quite interesting, having been there, obviously not for breast cancer, but for a brain tumour. There are a lot of differences in terms of the way I felt at the time that patients are cared for.
So I go back to where you were trying to talk about having NF2.
I think it's just having a better understanding of it. So I got an appointment at the NF2 clinic, but I wasn't given much information about what it would mean. And I've come across a really good charity called Can You Hear Us? Because obviously, as I said, a lot of people with it do go deaf. Because of these tumours on your hearing nerve. They're called acoustic neuromas or schwannomas. Mm-hmm. I think for me, just getting my head around and understanding that there's no cure and it's actually a progressive disorder. Nobody's actually said that to me. It was in a book that I got from the charity. Actually, somebody sitting down to look after me to make sure I understood that. And what that actually meant for me. I think that's what I did need, which I haven't had happen, unfortunately. But I think it's also, I think because the technology with genetics has accelerated and it's so new, there's going to be a lot more things like this, I think, where people are going to be, that's the way you're made, but there's nothing we can do about it. Just deal with the effects of it, I think.
Have you found there's a group, Meningioma UK?
Yeah, there's a couple of NF2 groups. And there's been a couple of conversations on there about things I didn't know about. Apparently there's a drug called Avastin, which can be used for people with NF2 to slow down the growth of the tumours. I don't know that much about it, but I've learned more through. And I've been able to ask questions on there with people. Sometimes children are diagnosed in childhood with NF2. As well. For me, I didn't actually have any, the brain tumour was my first real diagnosis 10 years ago, but didn't know I had this NF2 until literally September. So it's all very new to me and I'm still learning, but I'm happy to learn. I'm happy to find out more and just to educate myself. So I think for me, I like control. So for me, knowledge is control. So I can understand it and then I can accept it. And then you can move on with it, really. But everybody's different, aren't they?
I think they are different. That does work for you. Mm. For me, I don't like to know anything. I don't want to know what's going to happen. I actually am just going to go with it. But that's just me. Like, I get so frightened by all the knowledge, whereas actually for yourself and for many others, it's I want to know because I want to be 100% involved into what's happening to myself, whereas I'm like, I'm just going to trust you. You do it. But that's, it is the way everyone does it differently.
I think it is, it's dangerous sometimes, a little bit of knowledge, because I think I come from that allied health professional background. I need to understand things. I need to understand how they work. I need to know what that means to me. But sometimes a little bit of knowledge is dangerous because you join up the dots and you go off on one, and actually that isn't true. But also, I think, as you say, people need varying levels of knowledge and what they need to know. And for people like you, actually, that's too much to take in. I can't deal with it. Mm. I don't want to deal with it. I'd rather deal with what's happening to me now.
Mm.
And that's fine as well, isn't it? That's no right or wrong way of dealing with it.
No, there isn't. Exactly. It's what works for you. What would you say is one of the things you've remembered from your time in the hospital?
There was an amazing healthcare assistant on the ward called Marina. And I'm not very good at asking for help. I'm not very good at vocalizing my needs. I didn't want to be a burden to anybody. I didn't want to. And I was pretty poorly post-op. And she was the most amazing carer. She knew what I needed without me saying. And that was, she was very kind. The other kindness that I heard was my very good friend, Claire, who sadly passed away this year. She organized 10 of my girlfriends to make sure that my then husband and children, while I was in hospital, had hot dinners every night.
Oh, that's got to be one of the nicest things people do, actually, when just something like that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, that's lovely.
But she organized all my girlfriends, and it was just amazing that the care. And I don't know about you, but I didn't want anybody really to come and see me in hospital.
I didn't invite anybody.
But she came.
Yeah.
No, I didn't want people to see me like that.
No, I was the same.
But she came.
Mm. And you can't tell them anything because you've got, I couldn't speak. I was like, what are you doing here? Yeah. I don't want you to see me like this.
I've got a headache from hell. I was high on the drugs. But she came nearly every night to see me.
You're going to have another one. And knowing that all those things happened, but you got through it. Does that in a way give you a bit, I've done this before, I'll do this again and I'll have a little bit more of an understanding as to what they're about to do after.
Absolutely. Yeah, definitely. It'll be interesting to see how different it is from last time as well. One, I'm better prepared because I know what's going to happen, but also this tumour, as far as I know, isn't giving me any symptoms or isn't pressing on anything to put my balance off like the other one was. So that's going to be interesting because last time the physios, I didn't ever see occupational therapists. I saw physios and they were superb. And I'm a little bit, a little bit determined and a bit bloody minded at times. And the physio made me walk down the ward with a walking frame. I was like, I'm not going to use a walking frame. Okay, I'll use one. I was like, I'm not going to do that. All right, I will. I walked down the ward and the physio said, we'll get a chair to take you back to your bed. And I went, you will not, I will walk. So I did. And then they do a thing where they make you walk upstairs, don't they?
So
before you go home, make sure you can do it. And so we get to the stairs to try. It's the stairs of the actual hospital. And I'm going upstairs. The physio actually behind me said, will you slow down, woman? We're not doing a race. Because I was like, I want to go home. So I'm going, so it's okay. She said, I think you're fine with stairs. You can go home from our point of view. But yeah, a little bit determined and bloody minded at the best of times, I think. But that's just me.
You've carried on doing some charity work.
Yeah. So where I used to live, there was in one of the villages near where I lived, there was a young lass who did, I think she was 8 when she died of a brain tumour. Her parents, they still fundraise for the brain tumour charity. I was involved in helping out with things such as they used to do a Christmas fair every year.
Mm.
So I would go and help. I would go and volunteer. I helped organise a Twilight Walk to raise money.
My mum did that one.
With me. Oh, did she?
Yeah, she did the one that was up at Windsor. I'll be honest, I watched from, I was one of the ones on the side going, well, come on.
We organised our own in Cambridge. And did. The one thing I did do a year after my diagnosis, there was the Thames Pulse Walk, which is a charity. You could do 28, 50 or 100K. It was meant to be 25, but it turned out to 28 because we had a detour of 3 kilometres. But I did that. I think I raised about £600 for the Brain Tumour Charity.
Oh, that's
then. The other thing that I've done on my 5th anniversary and my 10th anniversary this year, there's fundraisers you can do via Facebook. And I've done those for the Brain Tumour Charity each time, as in just those landmark dates.
Yeah.
And the other thing I've been involved in is a charity called, they're based in Yorkshire. It's called Ellie's Fund, about the recycling. So I'm still involved in that. I still collect the ink cartridges and stamps, but I do what I can to promote just awareness and everything as well. Like when there was the Head Smart campaign, it's like, give me some leaflets, I'll hand them out. I'll put them in public places. Do all that kind of stuff to raise awareness as much as you can. Because it's the biggest killer of children under 40s. And the awareness is, I don't think people, I think because they're rare-ish, people don't think it's going to happen to them.
Mm.
But it is quite amazing, actually, when you start talking to people, oh, my sister-in-law had a brain tumour.
I know.
Like, oh, okay.
If you say it once and that's it, you'll hear it from all sorts of, that so-and-so had it. What's quite nice, though, I think, I had a friend of mine who her sister had it. She asked some questions and anything that I might have known. And then after she'd had surgery, she had it removed and she is completely back to her, as much as she can be. I don't think she actually has anything left that's left her to carry on after. And I was just like, it's actually amazing that does happen. It's just you don't hear it very often, or I don't hear that very often.
No, I know, it's amazing. It's just, and actually you saying that, one of my very close friends was diagnosed a couple of weeks ago with the same, a meningioma as well. And it's like, she texted me and said, I'm in your, what'd she say? Your team, I think.
Mm.
And I was like, why, what's happened? And she told me then she had surgery done just over a week ago and she's doing really well. But it's remarkable the amount of people go, oh, somebody with a brain tumour.
Yeah.
Do you?
Yeah, I completely agree. Maybe it is because our ears peak up and we hear brain tumour. Mm.
But even when celebrities have it, like Paul Daniels, and oh gosh, who was the M? Chester Gerald?
Yeah, that's it, Chester Gerald.
Yeah, she did the amazing campaign, didn't she? And she got some bill read out in Parliament over it. And I remember the brain tumour community saying, you've got to write to your MP, you've got to get them there. And I did to mine. Sadly, she passed away, didn't she?
But, yeah, she's left a massive legacy behind her.
Yeah, I think one of the things about having a brain tumour, and you and I, we recover, we're doing normal things, people forget.
Mm.
Yeah, and people, you look normal, you're fine.
Yeah.
You're cured. You're fine. You're all right. Actually, no, it's different. Life has changed.
Mm.
My outlook on life has changed and things are different. And I don't think, unless you've been there, I don't think you get it. You don't understand it, do you?
No. Is there anything else you want to mention?
I think definitely thank you to my children. They've not had the easiest ride. They've had my youngest daughter, Freya, was only 7 when I was diagnosed. And then my oldest daughter was 13 at the time, which is quite a vulnerable age. They are the most remarkable young women. And they've just, my oldest daughter, as I said earlier, she's just done her master's in genetics of all things.
Oh, wow.
And I'm so proud of her. She's doing so well.
Yeah.
And then my youngest daughter is looking for university and they're just amazing girls. They're just super. And then my partner, I've only been with him just over a year and a half and he is just the most amazing man. Andrew, he is he's been brilliant. He knew when I met him that I had brain tumour. And when obviously May, he came with me to the hospital to hear the news that I needed surgery. And we were buying a house at the time. And I said to him, you didn't sign up for any of this. And he said, I will be here for you, whatever. Just tell me what you need.
Mm.
I'm quite self-sufficient and I've had to be. And suddenly to have somebody to go, I'll do this with you, is just I can't describe it. It's amazing.
I really appreciate that you came on to just share your experience, and whatever you say will always benefit one other person to be like, I feel like that as well.
I hope somebody will get something out of it and feel that if they're feeling a bit lost or they need a bit of help and support, maybe this will help them. Mm. That's all we want to do, isn't it?
Yeah.
Nobody wants to join this club, but actually let's support each other as much as we can.
Yeah. Thank you very much.
No, thank you, Claire.
This is the Auntie Anne Brain Tumors Talk Show. It's a show full of informative chat and inspirational messages. The Auntie Anne Brain Tumors Talk Show on podcast.